From Impact Alpha, welcome to This Week in Impact, where we take you inside the world of sustainable finance and cover the agents of impact who are working towards a better future. I'm Brian Walsh. It's Thursday, April 4th. Helping me break down this week's impact news and insights is Impact Alpha's founder and CEO, David Bank. We'll continue to unpack the EPA's blockbuster $20 billion in government grants to mobilize commercial investment in climate solutions, learn lessons from dozens of blended finance transactions, and discuss how shareholders are voting to have companies mitigate economy-wide risks. All that and more on This Week in Impact. Hi, David. How are you doing this week?
Hi, Brian. I'm doing very well, thank you. We had the announcement finally that we've been waiting for, and I think we've even discussed on this podcast of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, and that kept us busy.
That's right. As we previewed in last week's podcast, the Biden EPA has now announced $20 billion in grant awards from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which was created under the historic climate legislation known as the Inflation Reduction Act. These grants aim to create a national financing network for clean energy and climate solutions, what some are referring to as a green bank. Now, David, this announcement wasn't news to Impact Alpha readers, as you and Amy Cortese reported last week that the likely grant recipients to receive funding were three coalitions: Power Forward, Climate United, and the Coalition for Green Capital. These networks have committed to focus on driving investment to low-income and disadvantaged communities, including rural and tribal communities. How do these coalitions plan on deploying this government funding?
Well, Brian, the specific names of the three major coalitions who split between them something called the National Climate Investment Fund, which is what people are calling the Green Bank, that was, as you said, we sort of knew that, but there are a lot of details yet to be worked out, obviously. Some of them came out today, you know, in terms of the size of the awards to each of the grantees. There's another $6 billion bucket for building the capacity and the infrastructure of these local lenders. So there's a lot of work now, and essentially it all kicks off to try to get this money out the door soon to local lenders for local projects, and also to leverage it into even more dollars. So this is a big sum of money, $20 billion. I think the largest sort of outlay from the IRA, as you mentioned, but the goal is to leverage it by about seven times of private capital. So this is going to be a sort of big market building effort to bring forth the kind of solar panels and EV chargers and energy retrofit projects all across the country, and importantly, very specifically, into low and moderate income communities. So a real sea change possibly on the climate side, and definitely also on the community lending side.
Now, David, you mentioned just now that the Biden administration claims that for every $1 of government money, we'll mobilize almost $7 of private commercial money over the next 7 years. So how do they see turning $20 billion of public funds into $150 billion of total investment? How does that work?
Well, that's what I was mentioning. This is like market building at its best and at its core. And for example, the CDFIs, the community development financial institutions that are at the center of this whole plan, really shined in pandemic days, and getting out that early PPP lending, as you remember, to small businesses. They were oftentimes much more responsive and channeled a lot more of that to keep a lot of small businesses open through those early days of the shutdown. And in various recovery bills, they've also gotten some additional capital. And this now is now a quite a large shot. And when a bank leverages, you know, equity capital, they can lend more, have more capacity, underwrite more loans. And all that brings in private capital as well to co-invest in those projects, to co-loan in those projects. So the real thing for our listeners in many ways is, how can private investors plug in to all of the programs that are going to be now financeable under this new green, you know, sort of distributed green bank?
So what are you going to be paying particular attention to in the months and years ahead as this money starts flowing through the community financing bloodstream?
Yeah, hurry up and wait, I guess, is where we're at now. And then projects will get developed and they'll get pitched, and banks will learn how to, and these CDFIs will learn how to underwrite them. And that will feel like a slow process. Whenever you pour $20 billion into an ecosystem, you can imagine there's going to be a lot of interest in folks in how to get some part of that for good. You know, I'm not just saying for bad, but for good as well. And so there will be proposals coming forward to retrofit, you know, every apartment building, and you can save this much money on your energy bills. And that will get, you know, financed over 20 years through a very standardized kind of agreement. And that will happen, you know, across the country in every city, in every neighborhood. And so there will be plenty of work for developers and contractors and project managers to pitch these kinds of projects. And that will become, you know, that will feel, we think that will feel like a kind of, upsurge of energy and business in local communities. So we're going to be watching for that very closely. And then, of course, as in all these things, you know, did that actually save energy? Did that actually reduce greenhouse gases? Did that actually, bring forth this kind of just transition that people are talking about? So, there's going to be a lot of eyes, not just ours, on, you know, whether this really works.
All right. Well, look forward to following this story as it continues. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll look at lessons from blended finance.
I'm Eric Carmen Gonzalez, Impact Alpha's Director of Subscription Growth. Ever feel like there's so much happening, it's hard to keep up? We hear you. That's why we created Impact Alpha Latin America, a monthly newsletter for impact investors who want to keep their eye on trends and investments happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. Follow the money and connect with agents of impact powering Latin America's impact economy. Visit our Instagram page at Impact Alpha and click on the link in our bio to sign up.
David, the hope of solving some of our greatest environmental, developmental, and social challenges depends to a large extent on the effective use of blended finance. This is when a relatively small amount of money that is willing to accept greater risks and or lower returns, often referred to as catalytic capital, is leveraged to attract larger amounts of fully commercial market rate money. As Kusi Hornberger and Marcos Paya of the consulting firm Dahlberg wrote in Impact Alpha this week, blended finance is struggling to take off, and little is known about how to get large blended finance deals off the ground. The pair used publicly available data to analyze the nearly 40 blended finance deals that had a total transaction size over $1 billion. David, what are some of the key lessons that they took away?
Well, the main one that was interesting is that there are, 39 of these billion-dollar plus blended finance transactions to analyze. Now, that's not a lot in the scheme of things. In fact, of all the blended finance transactions, it's only a tiny percentage. And blended finance itself is a tiny thing, but that there are at least 39 deals to analyze that of a scale that starts to get meaningful. And the reason why scale is important is not just because there's a lot of money, but because the leverage works better at bigger numbers. So if you put in a little bit of concessional capital and get a lot of commercial capital, you can get a better ratio of that bigger the number. The institutional investors, as it were, want to put down bigger checks. So the fact that blended finance is getting to that scale is a hopeful sign that it can attract institutional money.
And Convergence, which is the Canadian-based nonprofit that tracks global blended finance transactions, and they do a lot of things like provide knowledge and insights for the field, they describe four different types of blended finance archetypes. So one is, as you just mentioned, concessional debt or equity. Second are guarantees. The third is technical assistance, often known in this space as TA. And the fourth are design stage grants, kind of get these models off the ground. And according to this analysis by Hornberger and Paya, concessional debt or equity was by far the most popular with these larger deals, with the concessional layer representing an average of only 15% in these large blended finance transactions. So what does that imply for the future of this type of financing?
Well, they broke down these different deals. I mean, concessional debt and equity just means somebody's willing to take either more risk or lower returns to make a deal happen and take a sort of junior position in the stack, as it were. One of the interesting ones we covered in some, and I think it's called out in the report, is this billion-dollar SDG loan fund that Allianz, the big insurer, invested $1 billion in, and it's going to make loans in emerging markets that is capital gap that we've, as we've documented a lot for that kind of thing. It was guaranteed, the $1 billion was guaranteed by $100 million, I think, in first loss capital from FMO, which is the Dutch development finance agency. And but then even that kind of exposed FMO to regulatory and other kinds of risks that they couldn't exceed on their balance sheet. And so then that was in turn backstopped by $25 million from the MacArthur Foundation. So you had this nice stack where, from MacArthur's point of view, at some level, you know, the $25 million becomes over $1 billion in actual lending. And that's quite good leverage. The 15% you said is what I was referencing. I think the 7-to-1 seems to be a decent kind of leverage to get commercial money in. And like I said, that leverage rate goes up at the bigger the deals go. So that's what we're talking about in this report.
Now, blended finance, David, is tricky because it involves coordinating across capital providers that all have different motivations, and they have different financial incentives, different timeframes, and even different organizational cultures. But it's also crucial, as we noted, to solving some of our biggest challenges. So what are you going to be continuing to look at when you cover this financing approach moving forward?
Well, it's similar to the earlier story about the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. One of the things they found in the study was that only about a quarter of these projects had what they call smart impact objectives. You know, that's, I think, an MBA consultant term for specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound metrics. And so there's the financial aspects we've just been talking about. There's ultimately really what are the impact aspects, and are they measured, and are they reported, and can we actually tell that this subsidy, as it were, is actually achieving a social impact, which is the whole point of it. Like, why subsidize private capital if there's no social impact? So again, you know, we're seeing, you know, how these blended finance transactions play out in the marketplace, but also how they play out on the impact side.
So they look good on paper. They're able to get the transactions out the door and get to the scale. But is the impact actually happening down the line?
Well, one person's catalytic capital is somebody else's, you know, subsidy. So at some level, the private investor should be looking, where can we get a little risk reduction, a little profit boost. But certainly from the impact side and the catalytic side, they should be looking at, well, how can we get these private investors to actually be valuing impact and doing the right thing.
And how do we get these from innovative, bespoke to kind of, if you will, boring, plain vanilla, standardized over time?
Well, and where the catalytic subsidy layer is not even necessary anymore, because now this is an investable asset class.
There you go. All right, well, let's take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll take a look at the growing number of shareholder resolutions that are asking companies to address system-level issues.
Every day, Impact Alpha uncovers stories that make a difference to impact investors. I am Zalaim Abibo, Chief Operating Officer at Impact Alpha, here with a special reminder. Subscribers get the award-winning brief 5 days a week and so much more. Unlock exclusive coverage, get access to subscriber-only calls and Slack channels, plus search hundreds of jobs and internships at the Impact Alpha Career Hub. What are you waiting for? Subscribe today. Learn more at impactalpha.com/subscribe.
We're in the midst of the annual proxy season, that time of year when publicly listed companies have their annual meetings where shareholders elect board members and vote by proxy on various issues, hence it's called proxy season. Now, Billy Gridley wrote this week in Impact Alpha about how an increasing number of shareholder resolutions are focused on addressing not just an individual company's performance or risks, but on mitigating economy-wide risks. Among the more than 500 shareholder resolutions addressing material financial sustainability risks at corporations are more than 5 dozen that make system-level or beta stewardship arguments. Now, David, to begin, what is meant by system-level and beta stewardship? And can you give some examples of that?
Yeah, beta stewardship, I think, has mostly mystified people. We kind of liked it because we had impact alpha and then there's impact beta. But beta is sort of a measure of risk in your portfolio and volatility, I guess. And the argument of that is that you may succeed in one holding, one stock, one company, but put the rest of your portfolio at risk, and that therefore that you're overall come out behind. And that's not what investors like. And so the argument of the systemic system level investing is think about the portfolio as a whole, think about the economy as a whole, think about the marketplace as a whole, and optimize for that. And there's studies show, we've reported, our friend John Lukumnik and his in his book has said that most, I think 75 or even higher percent of your portfolio performance is based on these systemic factors. What does the Fed do on interest rates, or where is the global economy going? That rather than stock picking, and therefore pay attention to those systemic risks. And then obviously climate is one, and as we see others as well.
Now, according to the view of the Shareholder Commons nonprofit and others, the risks and returns of an entire portfolio matters more than those of a single company, as you just pointed out. And how are individual company leaders, whose expertise is ostensibly in managing a company's long-term financial performance on behalf of its investors, how are these company managers expected to address systemic issues?
Well, some of them are sort of, you know, plainly obvious. Like there's a couple resolutions at folks at places like Walmart and Target saying, you know, pay a living wage, and that the kind of economic insecurity that comes from low wages is a risk to both their customer base and their communities and the, you know, sort of economic climate as a whole. So it's a way to say, I think there's something like a dozen proposals flagging unfair wages and inequality. I mean, some that are a little more far field, maybe not so much though. There's a resolution at Home Depot on biodiversity. You can imagine that, you know, building supplies and everything has an impact and is impacted by sort of global supply chains, you know, across living systems and stuff. That one is, you know, is a little bit maybe general, but there's some that are very specific, like antimicrobial drugs, a huge issue that doesn't get enough attention, which is essentially antibiotic resistance, and companies, you know, big consumer, you know, fast food companies, you know, Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell and KFC and Pizza Hut, you know, and where they get their meat supplies and what are the antibiotic practices of those places. So you can have, corporations can have very direct effect on these things that are system level risks.
And why are we seeing the rise of these so-called systems level investing? And what do you expect to see next?
Well, I think because people, you know, we always have had a phrase which I've liked of universal owners. It basically says what I said earlier, which is it always applied to the biggest pension funds, biggest sovereign wealth funds. If you're like north of $100 billion in assets, you essentially own the market. You might be able to, you know, get a little edge here and there, but essentially if the market goes up, you'll go up. If the market goes down, you'll go down. Therefore, you want the global economic environment such that the market goes up. And so these very big institutional investors have always had this kind of system level idea of themselves as universal owners. That's why a lot of them have become more sustainable or responsible, because they see that they can't just sort of, you know, the world can't go to hell and they do well. They sort of understand that based, you know, very commonsensically. The question is, now we're all universal owners at some level. You know, many people are in 401ks or IRAs or other things, and, you know, broadly diversified across indexes and things. And so essentially whatever happens in the market's going to happen to us. And therefore, you know, we should pay attention to these system level risks. I guess what's new a little bit is that it's now sort of actionable. So everybody's had this notion, income inequality is a risk, climate change, obviously a risk. But these proxy votes, as you mentioned, make it actionable for bread and butter shareholders. And there are ways, we've written about an Impact Alpha, and we'll show more as the proxy season goes on, that retail investors in mutual funds or ETFs can vote their own proxies, in some cases at least. And, you know, it's shareholder democracy, you know, and it sends a message. You know, it's not going to change the ship, but it does send a message of what investors actually start to care about.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your insights, as always, David.
Thank you, Brian. It's always fun.
And thank you so much to all of you for listening to This Week in Impact. Now, David, what is the best way for people to contact us with feedback?
Thanks for asking, Brian. You can just send us an email to podcast@impactalpha.com.
Great. Well, we look forward to hearing from you. Now, if you liked what you heard, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen and share this with a friend or colleague. If you want to help us out, be sure to rate us and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. Believe it or not, it really helps other people find this show. This Week in Impact is a production of Impact Alpha and part of the Impact Alpha Podcast Network, bringing you investment news for a sustainable edge. For more exclusive stories about the world of impact investing and sustainable finance, join other agents of impact by subscribing to Impact Alpha. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe for full access. Thanks to our producer extraordinaire, Isaac Silk. I'm Brian Walsh. We'll see you next week for more Impact.